Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you very much. I understand there's a lot of us here who feeling negative Bentamian outcomes, so I'll try to be very quick and energetic at least. First of all, let me really thank the organizers, the Indian Law Institute and SILRAP. It's a privilege for someone like myself, who's really a practitioner and a policymaker, to be amongst the academics. It's my past, really. I spent 10 years teaching philosophy. But it's really a privilege to be in this company here. So let me start with policy as a starting point. When we talk about prevention is really on the top of the agenda of the international community once again. It's not the first time. And it really started with the Sustainable Development Goals. Goal 16, for the first time, makes a connection between development and prevention, sees development as having a role in it. UN Resolution 2282 of the Security Council, but also a twin resolution in the GEA, has stated basically that prevention really needs to look at broader set of actors and also broader set of means. It needs to now look into the preventing outbreak of conflict, recurrence, continuation, as well as what would be the fourth concept. So it's a really looking at the broader horizon of prevention that we need to engage with. So this attempt is not really new. In the Agenda for Peace, for example, in 1992, or the World Forum Agenda in 2005, we're clearly saying that there is something that can be, in fact, the effects of war can be minimized if we focus on preventing the war rather than responding to it through humanitarian action, to peacekeeping, and so on and so forth. And obviously, there's cost benefits for that. Now, what I am going to argue here is that, in fact, we can go much further to look at policy resolutions and policy responses. And these go all the way back to where we kind of started today in 1945. So my thesis is really that there is something we can learn from the policy debates about how we prevent recurrence of Nazi crimes. And one of the people who was instrumental in that particular discussion was, in fact, Hannah Arendt, a philosopher who was one of the stars of German philosophy, in a sense, Heidegger's student, Jaspers' student, who was the voice for Jewish immigration in 1945 in the US, a Holocaust survivor. So basically, what I think Arendt has done is to, for her thinking about this was occupied about three decades of her life, the last three decades of her life, starting in 45 until she died in 1975. And from the very point of inception in 1945, she basically shunned both options that were on the table. One option was Morgenthau Plan, which was in fact secretly agreed in Quebec City in September of 1944 between Roosevelt and Churchill, and in, I would say, a classical piece of Americana or DC politics, the plan was leaked to the public, and the public wasn't happy about the idea that Germany is going to be pasteurized. Basically, the industrial capacity will be leveled, just like it happened after the, to some extent, to make it more extreme than what the Versailles put on the table of Germans. So what also came in the Morgenthau Plan is that some unspecified number of Nazi Germans will be summarily killed. And so once that leaked to the pages of the New York Times, there was a public outcry, not so much about the summary executions, which Public opinion seemed to be very much pro that, but more for the idea of pasteurization. So at that point, obviously, we have, in a very short period of time, in a couple of months, the IMT was put in place in Nuremberg. And it's in January 1945 that Arendt has come out and basically said, has written her first intervention on this, and she said that neither political nor legal solution can actually in any way effectively deal with Nazi crimes. There, in fact, is no solution. And so my intention here will be to try to give some indication. I simply don't have time to go through her endeavor to do this, but give a sense of how we got to that point. What were her arguments to say that, as she was saying, that Nazi crimes were unprecedented. They break with the history to the such extent that we can no longer use neither political tools, no moral tools, no legal tools. We are in a situation that we simply have no solution for this, and we have no way to prevent this from happening again. And this will eventually come to the point that she will be singling out, and this crystallizes with Eichmann trial, with the idea that we need to have a particular mental capacity, in fact, that could inform us making decisions that will resist mass mobilization of people. In a nutshell, she did not look necessarily for measures of deterrence in terms of political leaders, in terms of security measures. She thought that the measures that could, in fact, be taken have to be civic measures. They come from the civil society and from resistance or resilience. I call that civic resilience that needs to be developed in order for us to be able to avoid repetition. It is only through finding solutions for civic resilience that we can avoid repetition of crimes. Now, how does she find this solution? Well, she looks into mental capacities that can, in fact, inform this model citizenship. And we'll see that she finds them into different philosophical sources. One of them is Kant's aesthetic judgment, so the theory of judging, and the other one is Socrates's critical thinking or examination that models Athenian citizenship. And so I will try to say a couple of things. In doing so, I have to say also that putting a model of prevention in Arendt is extremely complicated and tricky. The reason for that is that she has never built any particular doctrine where she deals with this problem and a number of others. And that, in fact, she would start with a particular problem and bring in conceptual framework, and then she would leave it, she would start something else and recast it without taking stock, without taking the conceptual framework. So, for example, if we look at her solution, and we'll get a little bit to say a little bit more about that, we will see that there is a certain inconsistency in building simply the theory of cognition based on Plato on the one hand, or Socrates, but it really in Plato's conceptual framework, and Kant. I will not attempt to reconcile this. My point here is to say that these type of mental capacities that we have, or faculties, as she calls it in a kind of a Kantian fashion, can in fact model a particular type of citizenship that in fact then can be promoted into something and be part of a preventive outlook that we can look at. And if we have a little bit more time towards the end, I will also show how some of the studies that we are doing at the moment, and in particular there's a UN World Bank study called the Pathways for Peace, where we look at taking a new stock of knowledge base for sustaining peace, how in this new framework of prevention, specifically this particular model fits very well into it. But before I get there, let me start by saying two or three things as to why is the Nazi regime brought about such an unprecedented event that has erased our ability to respond to it by means that are traditionally there. In the first outlook that she provides, and that's a 1945 article in Jewish Frontier, she basically says, obviously, she has no time and no patience for the political solutions. She says political solution didn't work. And it's only going to reinforce the Nazi policy in the first place. The legal solution she equally dismisses, saying that the categories of criminal justice system, and she really just rejects it without any particular analysis either of the legal basis or the trials obviously have not started, but she already erased the possibility of this being the case. But the problem is really acute, specifically because the Germans tried to do something that is called the organized guilt. As long as the Germans were winning, they were basically happy to have their elite units do the mass executions and killings. But once they started losing, she claims that Heinrich Himmler was in fact doing, intentionally trying to involve the broader segments of the population and erase the difference between the German society per se and the Nazi elite. But the real problem in this this kind of narrative was really the downfall of civic duty. So she is basically saying, let me just read a short paragraph. Quote, it is true that the development of this modern type of man, who is exact opposite of the citoyen, and whom, for lack of a better name, as we have called the bourgeois, enjoys particularly favored conditions in Germany. Hardly another country of Occidental culture was so little imbued with the classical virtue of civic behavior. In no other country did private life and private calculations play a great role. There is also hardly another country where, on the average, there is so little patriotism in Germany. And behind the chauvinistic claims of loyalty and courage, a fatal tendency to disloyalty and betrayal for optimistic reason is hidden. Okay? So, the real motivation here is not the nationalism, but it's really the ability to undermine because the private citizen has risen to a large extent in Germany, that's her theory, and that basically the concern for the family was the primary concern. There was a disgust for the political realm. Well, all the political ideas were equally unacceptable, and that was, in fact, where there was no space for those to act politically and participate in life, and that's what the Nazis explored. Now, nine years later, basically, The Origins of Totalitarians came out. And this is where we have a very different, though in some ways, again, similar characterization of now what we call a totalitarian regime, whereby we here not only looking at Nazi Germany, but we looking at Stalin's Soviet Union, though she makes some distinctions between those. But as far as we're talking about totalitarianism, what she says has actually failed is the customs. She's crediting Montesquieu, who actually was stating that there is a danger amongst European nations, that in some ways the laws can always be abused by authoritarian power, and all that binds the citizens is really the customary moral, the customs really, so the morality, traditional morality, and that morality cannot sustain for a very long time. So if morality is undermined, and she thinks that industrial revolution, which Montesquieu couldn't obviously predict or anticipate, has done as much, then there was a space to, in fact, not only to bring instability and violence, but in fact change the concept, and this is Montesquieu, this is not Arendt, change the concept of human being. And so she's saying that this was exactly what Nazis have done in terms of the Holocaust. It's really an experiment to change that concept. And that will have the bearings for later on when she talks about the crime against the human condition, which is very much the crime of genocide. So that's pretty much the analysis, and at this stage she is very much rejecting Nuremberg, and she is basically saying we have no solution. The solution is not there. So the part of solution emerges only with the Eichmann trial. And could you please pass me a note, because just to know when to wrap up, thank you. So with the Eichmann trial, we have several things happen. First of all, she opens up to the idea that legalism or legal approach, not legalism, that the courtroom is the place to understand what actually happened. So even if we do not have potentially legal categories in place to deal with the crimes of the magnitude that we see amongst the Nazis, and then the criticism here is mostly the criticism related to the type of punishment in relation to the magnitude of crime, but it's also related to the fact, and this is one of the things that will be actually at stake when we talk about Eichmann, the so-called lesser subordinates. So there's this group of those who are guilty and responsible, that's, you know, those are the Nazi leaders, architects, they can go to the court, but yet we don't have punishment, we don't have categories. There is a different group that is responsible but not guilty, those are the people devoted for and supported financially and so on, the Nazi party. And then there's the group of desk murderers like Eichmann, and those that are direct executioners. So obviously Eichmann was at one day conference when the final solution of the Jewish question was put on table, and he was a note taker. And so the point that she was trying to make earlier on, and I think then with Eichmann trial came very strongly into the foreplay, was that in fact there's no legal categories that can actually be used against them. Now, before we go to look at Eichmann's case, which we'll also do very briefly, unfortunately, we need to also say that in spite of some of those who have, in fact, argued that Arendt is very conservative in terms of legal philosophy, and that she insisted on basically meting out judgments for the individual and not looking at broader consequences, broader legal goods, so to speak. There is several of those, Shoshana Feldman, for example, and then Lawrence Douglas, who were actually insisted on this. So basically, I would say that there is plenty of evidence to actually show precisely the opposite. The reason why she insisted, there are several statements that give you that idea, but the reason is that she was very much against the prosecutor's strategy at the trial, because the prosecutor was largely trying to make a case that this is what Eichmann did is part of a very long history of persecution of Jews, going back to, you know, 10 centuries. And so she was thinking that this is simply simply inappropriate, and that is, you know, instrumentalizing the trial. And the story was not helped, obviously, by the fact that President Ben-Gurion was actively supporting this particular course of action, and apparently has stated that he doesn't care whether Eichmann's going to be, convicted or not. It is this broader, narrative of the young state that shows that it can deal with, has sovereignty and can deal with this type of crimes and can get back at people who have inflicted crimes such as Holocaust. So basically, she really thought that not only is counterproductive in terms of telling truth, because this is something very unprecedented, as I tried to make the point, and breaks with a history of persecution of Jews in a very significant way, and has consequences therefore for every for every one of us. It's not just the crime against the Jewish people, but the crime against humanity, she insists. So that's one problem. The other problem is that she thinks that this goes right into Eichmann's defense. Because, are we good? Yeah. So it goes right into Eichmann's defense because it is precisely what he wants to say. I'm a cog in a big historical machinery, and I am the one that that basically, I'm a scapegoat here. So, this puts him precisely in that frame. So, basically, to cut the long story short, because I really don't have that much time, the point is that she was looking at different forms of truth-telling, but not the truth-telling that we understand today. It's not the judicial truth. It's not the truth as a collection of witness statements or what we get from the documentation. It's really the moments of truth. There are certain witnesses that bring about something that reveals the truth, and it reveals what is unique and unprecedented about the Nazi crimes. In this way, it's very similar to Benjamin's fragmentary look at history. So that's one part. The second part is to basically say that with Eichmann, the problem is really that he was doing something like language games. You know, he was, for him, rules were like language games. Before the war, he was fishing very well before he was a Nazi. Then he was a Nazi. He can, you know, very well find himself in that. Then he finds himself in a courtroom in Jerusalem. It's all reversed again. And he finds that these norms are all fine, right? But without any consequences for himself. And to simplify the case, Arendt was basically saying that rule-following behavior is what gets people in trouble. And when we say people in trouble, it's the lesser subordinates, but also the people that en masse supported totalitarian regimes, the lesser subordinates. And that, in fact, for them, there is no illegal provision through which they could, in fact, understand the manifest illegality of these rules that were given to them. We obviously have, the Führer's command, which was made into a law as a locutory act, which could change the rules. And Arendt is saying, you know, by these standards, Eichmann was a law-abiding citizen. And so, there's a lot to be added to this picture about manifest illegality, because we have obviously there's a case in Israeli jurisprudence from 1956 that she analyzes and so on. We cannot go into details, there's no time. But the point is really that we, in order, she says, for us to be able to prevent this from happening again, we need to find a mental capacity that can judge right or wrong without using rules. So no Kantian ethics can help. No particular moral philosophy will work. We need to find a way to do this through a different mental capacity altogether. And so she only gets to understand that in the postscriptum of the Eichmann trial book. And then she spends the rest of her life looking for this. And just to cut a very long story short, she basically finds it in personal responsibility, that is a moral thing, where, and in Socrates' words, where he says it's better to suffer wrong than do wrong, right? And to understand this, you need to understand the idea of personal identity and the idea of silent dialogue with yourself, which is what thinking is, she says. Yeah? And so you're talking with yourself and you understand that you don't want to live with a genocide there. It's as simple as that. There needs to be some integrity here. I better suffer wrong than I live with myself as a genocide there for the rest of my days. Or I have a very good way to forget. Can anybody forget being genocide there? That's another thing. So that's one mechanism. The other mechanism she finds in Kantian aesthetics, and that's in the ability to basically judge through examples and to go to representative thinking. So do I have... Well, can I read that one passage and that's where I stop? I'm not going to go to the policy bit. But I can tell you, it's really about thinking about your actions by including everybody else in who happens to be around, in the political community. Community, the conditions of political community are essentially and ontologically plural. By definition, they're plural. Therefore, politics is in the realm of opinion, not in the realm of knowledge. Ethics, science is a realm of knowledge. Politics is about convincing people. And in order to convince them, you need to take everybody into account, especially minorities, especially those who are not here. And this is the model of citizenship that could help us. Unfortunately, I don't think I have time to go into the World Bank UN report, but we'll stay with this. You read the article.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.